I'll tell you what. My guest and I were both bobbing our heads to that tune, The Syncopated Clock. Leroy Anderson was the composer of it. But I thought it was good music to get us going here as we talk about circadian rhythms. And we're talking about the book. It's titled The Inner Clock, Living in Sync with Our Circadian Rhythms. A fascinating book. I really had a lot of fun reading it. And our guest to tell us more about the importance of circadian rhythms, Lynn Peoples. Lynn is a science journalist from Seattle. She was an MIT Knight Science Journalist Fellow, holds master's degrees in biostatistics from the Harvard School of Public Health, and in science journalism from New York University. And as we talk with her, I want to hear from you. Let us know what you notice about your body and how it responds to changes in the clock, maybe around daylight savings time one way or the other. Or maybe you have trouble getting to sleep at night, wondering how screens or other light sources might be affecting your bedtime routine. Lynn Peoples, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you, Larry. Happy to be here.
How many miles? Did you keep track of how many miles you put on in your exploration?
Oh, I totally should have. I mean, I can tell you a lot of jet lag was suffered over the course of researching the book.
I mean, you were in England, you were in New York, you were in, of course, Seattle, you were in, was it Arkansas?
Arkansas,
Alaska.
Yep, Denmark. Yeah. It got around.
Certainly had to affect your circadian rhythm.
For sure.
But a lot of people usually think about it in terms of sleep. But what other daily functions do our circadian rhythms control?
Yeah, the real question is, what don't they control? It was really eye-opening to me as I dove into this subject that circadian rhythms really drive most every function of our body. Because the truth is, just about every cell of our body has a clock, right? And so all our organs, everything from our metabolism to our defenses against invading pathogens to our sleep cycles, everything is dictated by the clock. And so we've got these clocks. They're all trying to coordinate with each other to anticipate the right time of day to do things. And they're also trying to coordinate with the sun, because these clocks don't tick at exactly 24 hours a day. That's where the circa and circadian comes from. It's about a day that these clocks tick on. And so, but to time things right for our body to live on this planet that has a 24-hour day, we need to keep everything in sync and keep in sync with the light and dark cycles that of this planet we live on. So that's where it's really driving and coordinating to make sure our body is efficient and doing those right things at the right times of day.
And you know what was really interesting to me as well is that all animals, insects, plants all operate that way, right?
Yes, just about all of life that scientists have investigated so far evolved to have these clocks. So obviously they're important. They are useful to survival. And as humans, we evolved with them as well.
What made you start thinking about your own inner clock?
Yeah, you know, I really think subconsciously it had been, well, obviously it's driving things for all of us. But as somebody who grew up in Seattle, where we're at a really high latitude, I didn't quite realize it, but, you know, we're above you. We're above a lot of like big Canadian cities even. And at this latitude, the days, you know, really fluctuate throughout the year, really long days, really short days. And like most places still today in high school, we started at before 7:30 a.m. So, you know, for months of the year, I was going to school basically in the dark, leaving after sports practice in the dark. And I noticed, you know, this very obvious change in kind of my mood and my energy. And throughout the course of the year. You know, summers versus winters, really different. And so, and I think, you know, I've always had sleep problems myself, struggled a lot with that growing up and continued as an adult. So these things were kind of going on in the background, but I didn't really think that much of it until I had moved back to Seattle after stints in Minnesota, which was actually really nice because the winters can be bright, like in Wisconsin with the sun reflecting off the snow. But I'd moved back to Seattle and I had visited this locker room of the Seattle Mariners, my hometown baseball team, and they had installed these new lights that you could adjust in intensity and color in the locker room. And the idea was to try to help the players' circadian rhythms, to energize them before games, to relax them after so they could sleep. And as this was being described to me, I remember thinking, whoa, you know, like, okay, this is what's driving them to do this because, you know, these players are not getting maybe adequate light and dark. And, you know, if it's really going to energize them before the game, what could that do for me? Like, should I be thinking about this? Could this explain my, you know, my lifelong struggles?
And so is that, that's probably why you decided to write this book.
Yes, exactly. That led me to write a one feature story on circadian lighting, which opened my eyes to so many other aspects of how circadian rhythms influence our well-being and our health. So I went down the circadian medicine rabbit hole next, and then it was just, I was all in.
Oh, man. Well, one part of the book that I found really interesting was when you spent 10 days in an underground bunker missile silo. You got to tell that story in the first place. How did you wind up there and what was it, you know, so forth?
Yeah, so I was motivated as part of the book to try to experience for myself what happened. Well, A, what do my inner clocks really, like what pace do they tick at? Because we're all our clocks are ticking a little differently. And that explains why there's some of us that are early birds and some are night owls and everything in between. So I wanted to get a sense of how do my clocks tick naturally without any cues? And then how, you know, what happens when they fall out of sync? So really I wanted to put myself in a space void of any input as to the 24-hour Earth day. So that's any daylight or anything else that's synced to that, right? So I cut myself off from other humans, like any media, and really any light, because light messes with our rhythms, as we might get to. So I was just searching far and wide. And on Airbnb, I found that this man had purchased a nuclear missile silo from the government. This had been used in the Cold War and sealed up for decades. But he popped it open and then spent many years souping it up into this luxurious Airbnb. And so I moved in for 10 days and we dimmed all the lights and only used red light, which is the color least likely to influence your circadian rhythms. So I lived under dim red light, decked out in a bunch of devices measuring everything from my heart rate to my temperature to my blood glucose levels. Didn't look at any clocks. And just try to live for 10 days and see what happened.
And it was, I mean, you had to tape over. Of course, there were all kinds of clocks and everything in this place that you had to.
Yep. It's amazing how many clocks are in our world. I didn't realize it until I was trying to avoid them, and they're everywhere.
And you kind of were synced in with some other folks, researchers, as part of this.
Yes. Yeah. Right, afterwards, yeah. So I collected all this data, and then some scientists helped me analyze that data and look at what happened to these various rhythms in my body. And yeah, sure enough, you know, a few days in, they started falling out of sync with each other and then falling out of sync with the 24-hour day. So my rhythms just drifted. And at one point I was completely flipped. I was living my days when the people above ground were sleeping.
And isn't that how animals, you know, wild animals, they're more active at night?
Some nocturnal species. Yes, right. There's a lot of nocturnal species that are most active at night. And then there's crepuscular, you know, active at sunrise, sunset. We, you know, if you kind of step back and think about the evolution of this planet, different species were finding different niches, right? So, you know, some were going to be taking advantage of the daylight part of the Earth, you know, day-night light dark cycles, and then the other species were, you know, filling in at night. And so their physiology evolved to take advantage of those, you know, what circumstances they would be in at during those particular hours. And the clocks helped them out.
Our guest today, Lynn Peoples, her book is titled The Inner Clock, Living in Sync with Our Circadian Rhythms. A fascinating book. Let's go to Glenn in Big Rapids, Michigan. Hi, Glenn. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call and for the show. I am wondering if your guest has looked at the proximity to the extreme edges of time zones and how that affects those populations. I've noticed that, you know, places that, like New York, is on the extreme eastern edge of the eastern time zone. I live on what would be the extreme western edge. And then it changes how the lengths of days sync up with the clock.
That is a really good question. And scientists have, and economists actually, have looked at some data to try to kind of tease out some of the differences. And in fact, I mean, as you're alluding to, the eastern side of a time zone, people there are being exposed to an earlier sunrise than on the western side, according to the, you know, the clock on the wall. Mm-hmm. And scientists have found that on the eastern edge of the time zone, people are, in fact, you know, on the whole, healthier. If you look at the data going from east to west within a time zone, cancer rates slightly increase. And also salaries start to decrease and longevity starts to decrease as you go from where the sun rises earlier to when the where the sun rises later. Because our clocks really are counting on that morning light to keep calibrated and in sync. And if we're missing that, you know, that early morning light and that light's getting pushed later, as it does under daylight saving time, for example, then there's some evidence that, you know, there are health consequences of that.
Ah, interesting. Glenn, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining in today. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Lynn Peoples. She is the author of the book, The Inner Clock, Living in Sync with Our Circadian Rhythms. And just a reminder, if you missed part of our show or just want to hear it again, you can always go to our archive at WPR.org/Larry to hear recordings of all of our broadcasts going back a long, long way. Christina in Glenwood City has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. You mentioned that you had sleep challenges. Has this been resolved as a result of your research? And what advice do you have for those who do have challenges and follow good sleep hygiene? Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great question. So it's an ongoing challenge for me, I will admit, but I have found some tools that definitely help. And I really have kind of broken it down to three really kind of core rules that I try my best to incorporate into my day-to-day to improve my sleep. And that is really finding contrast in my days, creating that contrast. So really trying to get my days bright, especially morning light, getting out for, you know, 20 minutes in the morning to walk to coffee if possible, or sitting on my balcony. I am fortunate to have a big window by my desk. So just trying to get as much light during the day as possible, and then really cutting the lights at night. Just trying to turn off, especially every overhead light, lights that have particularly blue wavelengths of light, you really want to try to cut out. And I use these electric candles around my apartment to just kind of create a nice warm glow. So it's really, yeah, the light and dark contrast. And then constricting my meal times as much as possible throughout the day to try to limit, because when we evolved really to eat during daylight hours. And so the science is really pointing to, in particular, the importance of cutting off any incoming calories a few hours before bed. And I find when I do that, I really do sleep a lot better. Just like 3 hours before bed, if I can not take in any, you know, sips of wine or any bites of, you know, chips or anything like that. Just sometimes hard to do to have a social life. And then finally, consistency. So if I can try to, you know, get up and go to bed at a similar time every night, it's so much easier to fall asleep and wake up at, you know, those times. So when I'm able to incorporate those three rules, I do find that my sleep problems are much resolved. But it's, you know, it's hard on our in society today, and you know, balance the social life and balance all these things. So,
and we're ongoing. We have light a lot. I mean,
yes.
Our society. I mean, we're under light many more hours than, say, an animal in the wild might be.
Right, unless they're exposed to light pollution. So we're actually, our light's invading their environments as well. But that is totally true. I mean, right, walk outside, our especially the new LED streetlights are very bright. You know, walk into a store and those grocery store lights are just really, you know, glaring. And then, you know, I'm, you know, more cognizant now, obviously, after doing all this research. But, you know, I walk into my dad's house or a friend's home, and now I just, those overhead lights seem so bright to me. But that's, yeah, it's what most of us are used to. So we have lights, we're exposed to artificial light many more hours of the day than if we were, say, camping.
Marty in Whitewater, your turn. Hi, Marty.
Good morning, good afternoon, rather. Thank you for taking my call. Circadian rhythms, is there any correlation between that and seasonal affective disorder? And I'll listen off air. Thank you.
All right, thank you for calling.
Yeah, good question. Absolutely. There is a lot of research that has looked into, the role of circadian rhythms and your being predisposed to seasonal affective disorder. So the rates of SAD are higher at higher latitudes, perhaps not surprising when you think about, you know, people I talk to in Alaska, where the days get really, really short in the winter and really long in the summer. And those throw the circadian, you know, really confused circadian rhythms. So there's ample evidence, and this is also pointing to potential tools that people can use if they're prone to the effects in the wintertime. And that's, you know, trying to make use of these sun lamps or other bright light that can, as closely as possible, mimic the sun. If you expose yourself to that in the morning for a particular amount of time, you know, usually they come with these lights will come with instructions, then that can kind of make up for the fact that it might still be dark outside and help reset your inner clocks as they were, you know, evolved really to anticipate that light in the morning. Because it's, you know, it wasn't that long ago that we migrated north and south. So there's certain populations with the genetics that might help them a little more at those extreme latitudes. And there's others of us that perhaps aren't quite ready for that. And so we might need to sort of trick our clocks in a way to give them the light in the dark, a little closer to the 12 hours a day that where we initially evolved at the equator.
So in the morning, the alarm clock for me goes off, my phone goes off at 5:40. And then I get up and then I go a couple, 3 miles through the neighborhood. I usually don't want to get up, be honest. But then once I get up, I'm fine. And it's more fun in the summer, although this morning when I was out, you know, we had a full moon and Mars was just to kind of lower right of the moon. And I was running along the lake. And there were lights across the lake that were pretty attractive, but I'm sure I'm going against my own probably circadian rhythm, because if we need an alarm clock, we're probably, as you well point out in your book, we're probably not in our rhythm. I have to do it because, I like to do it, but also because I, you know, there's a time constraint. I have to do my time outdoors, come back, take a shower, and then go to work.
Right. And do you do that same like routine 7 days a week? Do you get up at the same time when you're not working?
Probably not. On the average, it might be more like six.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I think that the key test, if you're living according to your inner clocks, is as you suggested, you know, are you using an alarm clock? If you're waking up to your alarm clock, that's not when your body wants to wake up. But that's the case for most of us. Most of us have to, you know, abide by some forced schedule on our lives. And the only way to really tell what your inner clocks really want to do naturally is to, shut off the alarm clock and basically to go on vacation. It takes a few days, but if you can let yourself just go and live according to what your body's telling you to do, you know, when to fall asleep, when to wake up, and then when during the day do you have, you know, the energy to go for a run, like you said, or to do various things. All these inclinations, all these particular, you know, strengths throughout the day will ebb and flow.
Yeah, and I think you're right, because I was on vacation for a week. Well, it's, you know, with the weekend days, it was 9 days. And I turned my clock off. And I did wake up early, but not quite as early as 5:40 every morning. And then I fell into what you call the Netflix effect, too.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Right. So, I mean, our clocks are somewhat malleable. So, you know, we have this genetic predisposition based on the way our clocks tick to rise and, you know, sleep at certain times of day, et cetera. But those, because they're, you know, only about 24 hours and respond to light and dark and these various inputs, we can kind of train them. So the fact that you still wake up, you know, reasonably early, you have kind of, you know, indeed trained your clock. So you're kind of, you've shifted a little bit. And then, yeah, this Netflix effect can happen. So because of the power of these inputs, if you say stay up late, expose yourself to artificial light, watch a Netflix show, stimulating the brain into a later hour, then, you know, wake up a little later, miss the morning light, it can essentially snowball. So then the next night, maybe you're up even later and, you know, under artificial light. And this can just, stack up and really put you out of sync.
Yeah, it can indeed. Craig had emailed back to Alaska for a minute, wondering if you went during extreme darkness or extreme sunlight, and you were there for extreme sunlight.
Yeah, I was
talk
there
about that experience. It sounded great in a lot of ways.
It certainly was a nicer experience than being in a bunker without any light. I did a long weekend camping under the midnight sun. So the sun would set where I was in Denali National Park at this particular time, but it never got dark. So it's, you know, barely dipped below the horizon, then popped kind of right back up. And I was there with a bunch of folks that lived in Anchorage and the surrounding area. So this was their reality, you know, they lived there and went through the seasons. And they were telling me about how they basically felt kind of this manic, you know, manic, depressive or bipolar moods throughout the year. And in the summer, like during our trip, it was, you know, it's more that manic. It's just like, you got to soak up every minute of sun while you got it. And you're energized. And I felt that my sleep was horrible. It's really hard to sleep in a tent when doesn't get dark. But that sun has this energizing effect. So light does more to us than just affect our rhythms. You know, it has, as we probably know intuitively, it's energizing, directly energizing, and has these other impacts that actually scientists are still exploring, which is fascinating. But that kind of compensated a little bit for my lack of sleep. So it was a lot of fun. It's definitely, I came back and just needed to sleep for a long time. But very different than being underground for 10 days, for sure.
One in the little aside that you had in the book relating to that was the change from light to dark and dark to light is very fast in Alaska.
Yes, right. Those transition weeks, right, where in the spring, where in the days are lengthening, and in the fall, when the days are shortening. I spoke with a sleep doctor in Fairbanks on my way to Denali. And he was talking about those were the periods of time where he actually saw the most patients with sleep troubles and other, you know, depression and various disorders that could be related to circadian rhythms. And indeed, I mean, we didn't evolve at these high latitudes. And so that quick change is really confusing our clocks, because our clocks, so they don't just serve as a daily clock, but they also serve as calendars. So as those days shrink, as we have, you know, varying inputs of light throughout the day, as those timings shift, that's telling our body that, oh, you know, spring is approaching or summer is approaching. And you can think how important this would be for a lot of species for when they're mating, when they might be migrating. So evolutionarily, yeah, these clocks serve a lot of purposes. And one is that calendar, and humans, you know, there's some effects here still, and it's very confusing when that's happening really, really rapidly.
Yeah.
And then, yeah.
And you noted that violence, or even domestic violence,
yes,
jumps in Alaska during those couple of times when the changes occur.
Yes, that is, yeah, that is what the sleep doctor had found, yep.
Mert emailed, what impact does not having a window in your office have on your circadian rhythm? And you do spend a fair amount of time in a chapter or two on offices and working. Somebody else, Todd, had emailed and wondering, what about workers on rotating schedules is another one we can take up. But what impact does not having a window in your office first have on your circadian rhythm?
Yeah, not having a window just makes it really tough for the body to know that it's daytime. I mean, that, you know, goes back to the importance of having that contrast, that really light day and that dark night. So again, I'm fortunate I have a window here. A lot of people are not. And you can think about the inequities that come up here too, because there's probably certain segments of the population that are most likely do not have access to that window corner office, right? You know, they might be working in a basement or a back of the house space or a warehouse. And so without that access to that bright blue rich light that the sun gives, the body is struggling to know that it's daytime and doing, you know, anticipating the activities that it needs to do during the daytime. Now, as we understand the importance of this, scientists are developing better artificial lights that are closer mimics of the sun that could be installed in some of these offices that can help.
And as long as we're on windows for a minute, you had a really interesting chapter, I thought, on England. You tell a little history of England, and there was a tax on windows.
Right. Yeah. Some centuries ago, they did use a tax on windows as a proxy for income tax, because you could think about, you know, a larger home, a richer family would have more windows, right? But people tried to get around this by bricking up their windows. And as I learned, you know, landlords would do this. So again, poor families, you know, may lose their windows as they were trying to evade taxes. So there was a period of time in which daylight was cut off to a large extent in a lot of these homes, just to cut down on taxes. And finally, enough people were kind of adamant about the importance of both light and air, because obviously if you cut off a window, you're not getting a lot of fresh air coming in, and they ultimately lifted the tax. But I got to see firsthand. I walked around London and saw some of these relics, some old bricked up windows. They're still out there.
And the first alarm clock was actually a person.
Yes, before we had our alarm clocks on our nightstands or our phones, there were human alarm clocks. So I learned about what were called knocker uppers. Yes, and they would walk the streets with a pipe in which they blew dried peas at people's bedroom windows to wake them up in the morning. So you think this is about the time that, you know, factories started employing workers, and, you know, they start at really early hours, and yeah, how are they going to wake up to get to work on time? So they would hire somebody to to wake them, to knock them up. And the little, you know, dried peas would rattle and wake them up. And then in some places, I mean, it was amusing. And in Italy, they had what were called hooters that would blow these really loud, shrieky whistles to wake people up.
So you had knocker-uppers and hooters. And the hooters got into trouble because the neighbors, who might not be happy to get up at that time,
they would wake them up too. Or, you know, if, you know, for the hooter themselves, they didn't want that to happen because they wanted all the money they could get. They want to, you know, they don't want to just blow one whistle to wake everybody up. They want to, you know, get paid for each customer. So
also a problem. You were getting at a little bit, and you spent some time on this, on the class problems that can be associated with buildings and structures. You mentioned Japan. There's a right to sunshine law that governs the height and shape of buildings. But I know you zeroed in on New York, but other large cities have similar. Just describe that a little bit.
Yeah, this really kind of stood out to me as I was doing my travels. I mean, there's really, well, I mean, step back. You think about food deserts, right? A lot of us have heard of that. There's particular neighborhoods where it's hard to get access to healthy food. And there also appears to be, you know, daylight deserts. And you can also think of darkness deserts, because again, we need daylight during the day, darkness at night. And, you know, poor families, certain segments of the population are more apt to be living in, say, basement apartments, you know, in the shadows of, especially in urban areas, you know, living in the shadows during the day, working in spaces, again, without access to daylight, without a window. And then at night, these are the same people that might be more prone to artificial light, this light pollution that's, you know, creeping into their bedrooms. So maybe they're living in a public housing project, which I walked through a few in both New York and London, where they have these massively bright LED, you know, lights up around, including, like, there's police floodlights in some areas, you know, to increase safety, right? That was the motivation for these, because there might be higher crime rates. And indeed, you know, there's people also probably lack blackout curtains to block out that light. And so they may not realize it, but this is, you know, impacting their sleep and, you know, just another factor that's perpetuating the inequities.
Even in Central Park, I think, along the edge of Central Park, you mentioned the high rise.
Yeah, these towers going up and casting shadows into public spaces. And yeah, there's talk about for, you know, little public parks or schoolyards where these big buildings are casting shadows. So kids are, you know, maybe not getting daylight while they're outdoors. Yeah.
Amazing stuff. You bring in so many different aspects of all this in your book. It's really a pleasure to read and to learn about. Lynn Peoples, our guest, her book is The Inner Clock, Living in Sync with Our Circadian Rhythms. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking with Lynn Peoples about her book, the main title, The Inner Clock. It's great to have her with us. Questions as we talk about circadian rhythms, what about yours? Doug in Barnes, Wisconsin has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Doug.
Hello. I was wondering if your guest would care to comment on changing daylight savings time. People seem to get rather wound up about it twice a year. And yet, I guess an observation that I would make is that while they want to maybe do away with daylight savings time, at the same time, people seem to have no qualms at all about traveling across time zones, either for work or for vacations, perhaps even just to spend a weekend. So in my mind, I'm wondering if we can survive that, if it really makes it that much difference, whether we would revert back. Other than, I think, for most people, it's the convenience of not having to change their clocks.
All right. Doug, thanks for calling. What do you think, Lynn? You spend a fair amount of time on that in your book.
Right. It's definitely something, you're right, that people have kind of gotten wound up about, winding our clocks forward and back, I guess. So the science really points to, if we want to lock the clock one way or another, I think the popular opinion is leaning still slightly towards going permanent daylight saving time. The science suggests that standard time is far healthier for our rhythms and everything they dictate for our bodies. And that's because taking that hour of morning light and putting it at the end of the day, which is what daylight saving time does, is kind of doing the opposite of what our rhythms want, right? We want that morning light and we want that nighttime darkness. And to your point, I mean, so I guess there's two issues with daylight saving time, and there's that acute effect of that hour loss, or that hour shift, twice a year. And sure, there's slight increases scientists have found in like car accidents and heart attacks immediately after that change, particularly in the spring forward, that week after we spring forward. But it is somewhat slight change. And you're right. I mean, people do accumulate more jet lag than even just that hour as we travel. But really the big issue at stake here, I think, is that long-term thinking about that hour shift. And now our bodies are kind of, an hour out of alignment from the day-night cycle of on our planet. So that's where scientists are really kind of keyed in on. And that's why they're like really cautioning against trying to go on permanent daylight saving time. And I know personally in Seattle, if we were on daylight saving time in the winter, the sun wouldn't rise until like 9 o'clock for some portion of the winter. And when you think about kids going to school, at 7 o'clock, and it's, there's a lot of ripple effects that we should be thinking about.
And there have been some schools, by the way, that, as you write about in the book, that have changed their times.
Yes, right. Minnesota, I believe, was kind of one of the leaders. Some districts there shifted. So middle and high school, this is what we're really thinking about. So in general, when you hit adolescence, your circadian rhythms drift a little later. So this is a good part of why teens have trouble getting up early and going to bed early. And that's because of their biology as well as some societal factors. But if you were forcing in general, or at least in previous decades, we've been forcing these adolescents to get up even earlier for middle and high school than they were in elementary school. Some districts now are flipping that. So they're having elementary schools start earlier and middle and high schools start later, which is more in line with biology.
And it seems to, and there were some results that were actually the students themselves were doing better.
Yeah, some studies have followed up, looked at before and after these time changes, including in Seattle. Seattle Public Schools made a change just about a decade ago almost now. And indeed, they found, kids are sleeping more, test scores are improving. So, yeah, there's evidence now that this is definitely beneficial. And if you think about this, I mean, sleep is really important for all of us, really important as you're still growing. And truncating sleep, if you're forcing a kid to get up too early, you're particularly cutting off some of their REM sleep, which happens at the end of the sleep cycle. And that is critically important to like solidifying memories and to, I guess in a way, controlling their behavior, because, you want that brain functioning well in adolescence in particular, when, these kids might be more vulnerable to certain things.
Doug, thank you for your question. Todd emailed, and this goes back to something I started to ask you about earlier, and then we didn't follow up on, how can workers on rotating schedules adapt their circadian rhythms to minimize fatigue and improve overall health?
Yeah, that is a really big challenge. Good question. So there are various, types of shift work. You got your night shifters, and these rotating shift workers are probably at the, face the greatest challenges. So the one idea that the scientist brought up to me, who's really, focused in on this, is because on average, our circadian rhythms are a little longer than 24 hours. If you are on a rotating schedule, hopefully your employer or whoever is setting the schedule is if they're doing rotating shifts, you know, shifting your shift a little later each day. Because if your rhythms are a little longer, that means it's going to be a little easier, you know, to stay up a little later, stay up a little later. And then if you're, you know, flipping back and forth, the idea is to try to minimize that whiplash you're giving to your body. So if you're on a, you know, a day shift one day and then on a night shift another day, try to, you know, shift or try to move your sleep times and your wake up times a little closer to each other. So they're not quite so extreme. So maybe that does mean sleeping in on the weekends, right? If you're going to be doing a night shift, so you're just the most you can minimize that whiplash, the better. But on the whole, it's tough. Where, you know, consistency is really important for our circadian rhythms and all they run in our body. So, but there are things you could do.
there was another piece that I found really interesting. Well, I found all of it interesting, but you get into a bit about athletes, and, you know, now in this day and age, where we're traveling across the country. Here, the Big Ten is now from one coast to the other coast, as an example. And what is the impact of that for a team like the, well, let's say Rutgers, which is way over on the East Coast, and then they've got to go play UCLA or Oregon or Washington on the other coast, and of course vice versa.
Right. Yeah. I find this really interesting and really.
There was a guy who really got into that, and you talk about sort of he really got into the numbers on that.
Yeah. Right. I mean, so, you know, I grew up, obviously I've mentioned the Mariners. I grew up a Seattle sports fan, and I was talking to this guy in Portland who also is a fan of Seattle sports as well as Portland sports. And he dove into data that was looking at the NBA during COVID when they went into a bubble in Disney World to play for the playoffs. So that essentially removed all these excess factors of time zones and jet lag, right? And you look to see how did those players perform relative to each other and then relative to before the pandemic. And sure enough, you know, the bubble really leveled the playing field because, as he's found and some other scientists I've talked to, our bodies, again, everything's on a rhythm. And on average, our athletic performance peaks in the late afternoon or early evening. So if you have a team from the East Coast flying to the West Coast for a competition, let's say it's NFL football and the kickoff is at 1 p.m., right? So maybe you have, the New York Giants or something are flying into Seattle. At 1 p.m. in Seattle, their inner clocks are still ticking at about 4 p.m., right? Because they're East Coast time. That is about the start of, on average, peak athletic performance. Whereas the Seattle team is kind of on their midday slump. And so there's an uneven playing field there you could think about. So like you said, we have these college athletic conferences forcing these players to travel across time zones. So A, you've got more of a factor of jet lag, more hours, you know, away from school, and then plus perhaps, you know, less equity in circadian clocks and circadian performance, which is not something that was probably considered when these decisions were made.
Well, it is interesting. I thought back to a long time back to 1993 when the Badgers football team was playing a game in Japan against Michigan State. And it was a year. And it was kind of a bowl game. The Badgers actually also played in the Rose Bowl that year or that season. But Barry Alvarez, who was the coach, talked to a sleep specialist professor here at the university. And he had time because they knew it was coming. And I forget how it actually worked, but the guy had suggested that the players fall asleep a half hour earlier each night for I forget how many nights. But anyway, and it turned out that both teams were flying on the same plane to Japan. And Barry Alvarez said he walked through the plane at one point, and all the Michigan State players were asleep, and all the Badger players were awake. And he said he knew right then we were gonna that the Badgers were gonna win the game.
And they won.
And they won.
Woo. All right. Yes. Oh, he was ahead of his time. And yes, there are now chrono coaches out there helping teams to do various things just like that. Yeah, just ahead of travel, which we can all take advantage of if we're like facing, you know, potential jet lag on vacation. And then using light, you know, strategically timed bright blue light, and then blue light blocking glasses at other times to help kind of more rapidly change your rhythms to line up with your destination time zone. So a lot of tools.
Yeah. Didn't you give a lamp to a friend who was going on a submarine or something?
Right. It was a Coast Guard icebreaker that was headed to the Arctic. Yeah. So basically the same thing, because that, you know, at some point as they're headed north, well, there was no more light. The sun set and it didn't come back up. So I was hoping that sun lamp would kind of help him again trick his clocks into creating a day. And you know, anecdotally, N of one, but he found indeed that it helped. It helped his sleep, it helped his mood, it's helped his productivity. And I mean, the science does support this notion.
I thought it was funny too, because there were a couple of other lamps that had been given to other crew members as jokes, but it turned out they wound up using them anyway. Is there, you do talk about a link between circadian rhythms and Alzheimer's.
Yes. Among other chronic diseases, scientists are honing in on links. And it's looking, as far as dementia, Alzheimer's, cognitive decline, it's looking like it probably a two-way street where the damaged part of the brain in Alzheimer's is actually, you know, touching or basically part of what is helping to drive circadian rhythms. So A. And then B, there's evidence to suggest that as our circadian rhythms weaken as we age, that could be, and if you know, if you have more disruption, that could be driving a more rapid pace at which you have, you know, the beta amyloid plaques, you know, building up in the brain. So there's a lot more research underway right now to really sort that out. We don't totally understand, but it looks like this two-way street, which is also pointing to maybe some new potential preventative strategies or ways to minimize some of the effects of Alzheimer's.
Yeah. So here we are getting out of time. What do you hope people take away with them after reading your book, The Inner Clock? I mean, it was really entertaining to begin with, but what do you hope people take away?
Yeah, I mean, I hope it's kind of an eye-opener to these kind of subtle effects that are happening inside of you, but having these profound effects on how your, you know, how your day-to-days are going, and then your long-term health and productivity. So I think there's, you know, things individuals can do, you know, again, you know, that contrast, that constricting meal times, and that consistency, kind of the three C's. So as individuals, we can do that to help our rhythms. And then broadly, thinking about as a society, what are some relatively low-hanging fruit that we can, ideas that we can implement to help everyone? And, you know, thinking about the equity concerns, thinking about daylight saving time, school start times, how we draw time zones, like all these things could potentially affect, you know, population-wide health.
Well, it's a great book. And Lynn, thank you so much for writing it. Let me know the next book you write, and we'll get you back whatever it is. Thanks so much.
I really appreciate it, Larry. Thank you.
Lynn Peeples, her book is The Inner Clock, Living in Sync with Our Circadian Rhythms. Really fascinating. We didn't get into, we just touched the surface with her book. And so you'll learn a lot more if you read it. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller.